This episode is brought to you by EFG Holding, a trailblazing financial institution with a universal bank in Egypt and the leading investment bank in the Middle East and North Africa.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello again from ANT Media. I'm Malak Fouad, and you're listening to What I Did Next. I welcome a new guest each episode, and we take a deep dive into their personal journeys, exploring the twists and turns their lives have taken to better understand what these pivotal moments mean. On today's episode, Sir Megdi Yaoub tells me why he has always worked to push new frontiers in cardiology.
Pushing frontiers is never easy. Everybody is against you. They say, have that been tried before? Are you experimenting on patients for your personal glory? And that used to upset me, no end. It's nothing to do with personal glory. Actually, it was very, very difficult because once you go out beyond what is known, you are completely in the dark, you are on your own, and that is very destabilizing. But I was doing it on behalf of the patient because this patient-doctor relationship was, as I keep calling it, sacred.
Sir Megdi Yaoub has almost single-handedly revolutionized cardiology from his early days as a junior doctor in 1960s London to retirement from his beloved NHS in 2001. He performed the first combined heart and lung transplant in 1983, the first domino operation in 1987, where he transplanted a donor's heart and lungs to a 50-year-old woman with failing lungs, then giving her healthy heart to a 34-year-old man. Along the way, he established the largest heart and lung transplantation program in the world at Harefield Hospital in the UK, where more than 2,500 transplant operations have been performed. And yet, as I list these groundbreaking procedures, it's easy to forget that there was a time when he was considered a dangerous maverick, pushing the boundaries of what was possible on the operating table and going head-to-head with the cautious British medical establishment. Lawsuits, negative press, and persistent doubts hung over him. However, one thing rarely wavered, and that was the support and faith patients' families had in the prof, even when outcomes were bad. He has, of course, been vindicated, and then some. Today, Professor Yaoub dedicates his time to his Chain of Hope charity, shepherding the construction of state-of-the-art centers in Cairo and Kigali, Rwanda. These new centers follow the incredible success of the Aswan Heart Center in Upper Egypt. His much-anticipated biography, A Surgeon and a Maverick, The Life and Pioneering Work of Megdi Yaoub by Simon Pearson and Fiona Gorman, is now available at AUC Press. He has pledged a percentage of the book royalties to the Megdi Yaoub Foundation in Cairo. You can find more information on both the foundation and the book in our show notes. Professor Yaoub has been on my top 10 list of dream guests since the show began in 2021. He was a joy to interview, and the breadth of his knowledge is incredible. If anything, our chat was all too brief. Like many of my guests, Professor Yaoub knew exactly what he wanted to do at an early age.
My dad was a doctor, and I was watching him with admiration. And then he lost his younger beloved sister due to narrowing of the mitral valve, and it just destroyed him. He had a nervous breakdown, and I declared I was like 4 or 5, something ridiculous. And I said, well, I would like to be a heart surgeon. Why did I say that even at that time? Because I felt already this inequality in healthcare delivery. And that's continued with me when I graduated from Asri Laini, the Cairo University. During my residency, I was a houseman, and I befriended a young boy, age 7. I remember him very vividly. I think his name was Ahmad. And Ahmad was a little boy, was very, very intelligent, but he had free leakage in his aortic valve, the valve coming out of the heart. And what happened to him? That he every night he would develop pulmonary edema, that is water on the lung, and cannot breathe and cannot sleep. And I used to go in the middle of the night again and sit with him, give him literally a placebo injection just to convince him that we are caring for him, and continue talking to him until he goes to sleep. That happened on almost nightly basis. It affected me in a very big way because I thought, my God, this is the mechanical lesion and the rest of the heart was pumping all right. And Ahmed knew at this very early age that he was going to die in a short time. And he accepted it. And that just upset me no end. And I said, God, you know, the mechanical lesion should be one day somehow be repaired, particularly like opening the mitral valve for my aunt and so on. These are, all right, isolated incidences, but left a very big mark on my conscience and my will.
It's fascinating how these experiences when we're very young leave such a formidable impact on us, and they spur you on to make life-altering decisions. I know that after this, you moved to the UK. You chose to work under Professor Russell Brock. You found yourself working at the NHS, but then decided to take a one-year post at the University of Chicago, only to then come back to the UK and go back to the NHS. But I wondered, what made you decide to try the US? What was it that you thought perhaps was lacking in the UK that you thought you might find in the US? What was the trigger for that?
At that time, at least there was a feeling that research is more advanced in the US. And all young people wanted to spend from the UK, spend some time in the US to get more familiar with research. I mean, I think that has been addressed since then, that research efforts in the UK and Europe is just as good, if not better, than the US at time. Even at that time, I realized that the solution for diseases, and like in heart disease, could only be solved by applying science to it, and that research was a fundamental part of the service. And that's continued with me throughout. But that's the reason why I went to Chicago at the time.
You then returned to the UK, went back into the NHS. And what is it about the NHS model that appealed to you? The idea of equality, of medicine for all, was that what appealed to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Equity is fantastic. And I sampled that firsthand when I practiced in Chicago. I loved Chicago in a big, big way. Because I identified with medical students, and we used to work all night, either experiments or reading, or but doing experimental procedures. When we had an emergency during the night, the kids worked with me all night, running around, getting blood, getting this and that. And one notable example, one evening, we had a relatively young person with a ruptured main vessel coming out of the heart, and he was just going to die any minute. And we rallied around all night, literally, until we could save him. And 2 weeks later, he comes in and says, "Doctor, I have paid $50 and you are 10 minutes late. That was really bad because we said, we don't care about your $50. We don't get it anyway. The students were standing by looking at the x-rays and thinking, my God, this guy was going to die. And now he is a picture of health. And they were proud of that. And we were not thinking about the money. Actually, we were extremely hurt that he is treating us as a commodity.
A service.
Yeah, service. He paid $50 as if he's going to the supermarket.
Yeah.
And that will never happen in the UK. Patient-doctor relationship, even if it is not as spectacular as I've just mentioned it. The patients always come back to you and say, doctor, how lovely to see you. Because this, what I call the sacred relationship between the patient and doctor is absolutely essential, not only for the patient, but for the doctor.
Of course.
Because you feel that I am the advocate of the patient. I am going to try harder, etc. But to say, I bought your services, and you are just like a piece of merchandise.
Yeah.
It's very hurting and bad for the patient and bad for the doctor.
Yeah.
So that's why I love the NHS with all its problems. Nothing in life doesn't have problems. And rather than throw it away, mend it.
Yeah. I think the story you just shared, it tells a lot about the American character versus the British character as well. It's very monetary based in America, but Britain, you know, it's quite different. I wanted to talk to you about your attitude towards patients. You are clearly a doctor who puts a patient above all else, and you have been willing to fight for what you can provide these patients, fight the establishment, fight hospitals, fight government, fight laws, et cetera, et cetera. What made you, as an individual, keep pushing the envelope, keep saying, we need to try it? All throughout the 70s and the 80s, all these amazing operations that were the first of their kind, when everyone was pushing against you and trying to prevent you doing all these experimental procedures. What was the motivation for you to keep going for that?
I was simply acting as, again, the patient's advocate. Now, pushing frontiers is never easy because everybody is against you. They say, have that been tried before? Are you experimenting on patients for your personal glory? And that used to upset me, no end. It's nothing to do with personal glory. Actually, it was very, very difficult because once you go out beyond what is known, you are completely in the dark, you are on your own, and anything can happen. And that is very destabilizing. But I was doing it on behalf of the patient, and I wanted to do my utmost and a bit more. And with basic science, with logic and so on, you think, oh, this is a reasonable thing to try. Oh, but people say, has it been tried before? Have you done it on animal model? Have you done it in the preclinical on the bench and all this and that, like what happens now? That pulls medicine back. You really, like Karl Popper, the philosopher of science, says, medicine is not like that. It's not moving slowly in a predictable manner, but there are leaps. And these leaps usually can be reasonable, but it has to be audited very, very heavily. And that's good that nobody is above criticism and what the debates which went on were actually enjoyable. And I took part of them, criticizing myself a lot of the time. And people say, why are you criticizing? Well, in a proper-like manner, I wanted to reach the truth and to benefit my patient to the utmost, and that was not easy. So that's the story of pushing frontiers, and in the process, suffering, but also enjoying, defying dogma.
When we come back in a moment, Professor Ya'oub tells me about his decision to publish a biography and how he feels about the philosophical and theological sides of life as a doctor. That's right after this break. This episode is brought to you by EFG Holding. For 40 years, EFG Holding has been realizing more for its clients across its three distinct verticals: EFG Hermes, the investment bank, EFG Finance, the non-bank financial institutions platform, and AI Bank, the commercial bank for clients looking to EFG Holding as a gateway to the most compelling equities in frontier and emerging markets. EFG Holding is for investors looking into renewables, healthcare, and education, for consumers seeking innovative solutions to achieve financial freedom, from purchasing a home to educating their children, for businesses of all sizes working to unlock their full potential, for shareholders who require visibility, profitability, and confidence in our growth strategies, and for communities in need of sustainable development to drive change. EFG Holding's goal is to build an ecosystem of businesses that work seamlessly together to provide clients with best-in-class, end-to-end financial solutions at every stage of their lives or the growth of their businesses, creating a positive impact on our society, economy, and the environment. EFG Holding is a trailblazing financial institution with a universal bank in Egypt and the leading investment bank in the Middle East and North Africa. See the world differently and realize more with EFG Holding. Welcome back. This is my conversation with Sir Megdi Ya'oub. You've got an amazing biography coming out. And I wanted to know what made you decide that this was the right time for you to sit down with the two authors and talk about your life journey.
I always maintain that writing a book, on autobiography anyway, is a waste of time for two reasons. One, that something else has to go, and that really, even at my age and my time in life, very, very busy doing many things. So I didn't want to give up something professional for writing the book. The second, I was put off by autobiographies, putting the person himself on a pedestal, because I do not consider myself anybody special. I just am a person enjoying doing his job. Why I changed my mind is because I got really convinced by my daughter, as well as by the two reporters from the Times, that they are going to write something responsible, humanistic, with science, and will not involve me in too much work. They will just come weekends and talk to me only. And the other thing is, they point out all the good, the bad, and the ugly, and don't put me on a pedestal. So that was a very important thing. And I saw the writings of the Battle of Britain showing that they really concentrated on the humanistic part of the Battle of Britain. The final point was that when I go around the world, in Yemen, anywhere, in South America, in Syria, I find a lot of young people saying, "We went in medicine just because we knew about you." So I wanted to give them the true story of medicine. It's not an easy journey, but it's really worthwhile. So I wanted to make other people see the value of doing something for the community. So these are what convinced me to change my mind.
You've spoken a lot today with me about not having the need for recognition in yourself of doing this because it's your mission, it's your calling, vocation. Medicine is a vocation. But I wonder whether now that you look back on all those, you know, very difficult early years where you were pushing the envelope, do you feel a sense of vindication now that all that you had pushed for has come about successfully, is being replicated around the world? Do you have a feeling of vindication now?
Yeah, I have a feeling of satisfaction. Not all of them have been successful, but the majority, and that gives me a lot of happiness. But I still feel that the satisfaction rather than the macho thing that I told you, that I am wonderful, that's a really bad feeling, because arrogance is a recipe for disaster. And I tell that to all my trainees, whether they are scientists or clinicians, that if you are arrogant, you think you're at the top of things and you're always right, you will never progress. And that is both in science and... So I'm not arrogant, and I just would like to point out again that I was just doing my duty. And in so doing, that gives me happiness and satisfaction, regardless of anything else what other people say.
I wanted to ask you a couple of maybe more philosophical questions, which I'm sure you've confronted across your career, which is, how do you answer people who talk to you about religion and say to you, well, damin rabbina, this is God's will, when someone refuses an operation or if an operation goes bad? How do you deal with that? And how do you must have come across people who have been anti-medicine and anti-progress in medicine? How have you rationalized that with them, convinced them of the scientific route? And has that evolved with time? And I'm not just thinking of the perspective from where I'm sitting in the Middle East, where Islam has certain prescripts, but I'm also thinking of your earlier career in the UK, where a lot of people were not wanting to go into the pioneering realm when it came to medicine.
Yeah, I deal with that relatively easily. I say God or the powers, whichever they are, whoever they are, do not want you to just sit there and do nothing and say they will do everything. You have to be trying yourself, and otherwise you are totally negligent. And religion can be good and can be bad, because the goodness is that they give hope and strong belief that I should continue. And there is one example which I always remember and quote, in Jehovah's Witnesses, who would refuse to allow giving blood to their children. And I was doing a lot of complex operations for Jehovah's Witnesses. But I said to them, if the time comes for this tiny baby who will need blood, I will give the blood. And they said, no, that's against our religion. Okay, I respect your religion, and that's why I'm trying to do the operation. And in 90%, I get away with it. But in the 10% when we need to give blood, my religion dictates that I have to give blood, because I cannot allow a baby to die in front of my eyes when I can prevent it. Says, well, guess what they say? Oh, now you respect our religion? We respect your religion of not allowing people to die. So is this mutual respect of each other, different religions and different beliefs, is fundamental in dealing with the problems.
When we come back, Professor Ya'oub tells me how he continues to contribute to medicine post-retirement. I wanted to take a minute to tell you about our bonus episodes, available exclusively for subscribers. On each bonus episode, I take a deeper dive into my guests' industries, and I share some extra parts from our conversation. For example, actor and comedian Rami Youssef told me about his thoughts on cancel culture, and ex-anchor and now author Hela Gorani told me her thoughts on the future of journalism. All of these great stories are only available on our bonus episodes, so subscribe now to unlock this amazing extra content. You can subscribe in Apple Podcasts by clicking the subscribe button or on our website and get instant access to all our bonus episodes with a 2-week free trial. And now, back to the show. Welcome back to my conversation with Sir Megdi Ya'oub. This show, What I Did Next, focuses on people's pivot points in life and how these pivot points take you from one place to the other. Sometimes they're unconscious, sometimes they're done with purpose. And looking at your career and all of the operations that you pioneered, it's hard to pinpoint one or two pivots. I mean, to me, it seems like each one was a pivot, not just in your own life, but in the trajectory of cardiac surgery. If you could pick one or two of these points, which for you would stand out as for yourself, important, but also for the specialty of cardiology as well?
And that's a very hard question. It is like asking which of your children you love most. I love them all. And I think each one of them has its own merit. So it's very difficult. But if you say, you must enjoy something because it has had a massive or a large impact, there are things like valve-conserving operations for aneurysms. I started that, and it has benefited many, many people in different ways after a lot of debate. And the other one is the arterial switch operation in infants and neonates. That was quite an achievement. It wasn't only me. There was, at that time, ideas mature, and there were many of us working on it, both in South America and almost unknowingly moving in the same direction. And that was quite an interesting thing because there are thousands and thousands. And that process continues today because in Aswan, we still, with my group, pioneer very new operations to try and make it easier and more applicable to the developing world who cannot afford very expensive conduits or keeping the children in hospital for a long time, etc., etc. All that is very appealing because it saves lives.
I know that you retired kicking and screaming. You didn't really want to go at all, but the official retirement age had crept up on you. But you continued with your endeavors through the Chain of Hope. Tell us a little bit about your philosophy for that and how it evolved and where things are now with it.
The Chain of Hope is one of the efforts, and it was one of the biggest effort or earliest efforts to actually build a sustainable system which serves underprivileged communities and perform research and make sure that all the endeavors, either research or surgery or cardiology, are all done by local people, and that is ensures sustainability. But since then, the biggest hospital is the one in Aswan Heart Center, because going on missions for very short times is very useful to pointing out the need and how things can be done. But in the longer term, Aldo Castaneda, who is one of my idols, used to say it is surgical tourism, but it does serve something. The important thing is to have something sustainable for the future, which will continue a long time after we have gone. And there are efforts. One is a huge hospital just by the pyramids in Giza, and that is will be open early next year.
I'm curious to develop a little bit this idea that you mentioned of surgical tourism. And I know that Chain of Hope, when it started, you and your team of volunteer doctors would travel to the Caribbean and to various other places underdeveloped to provide know-how in conducting operations. But I find it interesting that with experience now, you are realizing that having a solid base is more sustainable. But are you still conducting those missions as well, or is it now more focused on hospitals?
We're still conducting missions and helping groups, and that's really important to point out to the local population, as well as in the UK and the US, the need, because by going doing something which could not have been done, and the children would have died, and we ensure that a team will remain there until the last child has gone home, and importantly, follow them through, follow up is mandatory. That's really essential, because if you don't do it, people in that country forget that there is a need. And they say, oh, you know, we accept it. Children do die. I don't think children just do die from no obvious reason. But you point out, no, these children do not deserve to die, and we can save a few. And then you have to start helping us and building a sustainable system here. And that the same happens in the UK and the US. When say, oh my God, look at these children, deserving children, how they have improved, and we love them, and we go and see them, and remember. So it is essential to continue to do that on a selective basis, to point out that there is a need, and to identify people who are called stakeholders for the future, who will be useful in the sustainable system. So it is something which is still necessary as we speak.
I know that you have passionate hobbies, partly very well known is your hobby of gardening. And I wondered whether you are able to spend your time reading or watching anything, documentaries, anything that's left an impact on you recently.
I love gardening because it's related to what I do in terms of life, seeing things grow, looking after plants and individuals who require special care, and see them bloom and do wonderful things. So that is something I always loved since my childhood and continue to do so. With regard to reading, I am most of the time reading scientific journals because the progress in science is incredibly fast. And in my job, I would like to be right at the edge of what's happening. And almost every hour, there are new things happening. So I do that. And I do that usually during the night between 2 and 4 a.m. But also, I love to catch up with history because I'm totally fascinated by what has happened in the past, particularly as it relates to science and scientists. So I love to read about the life of Robert Koch, of other people in science, the German scientists who really laid the foundation for true science, Galileo Galilei. It's very inspiring and to know who they are and how they struggled and how they enjoyed what they were doing is a great thing to me.
I'm curious, you said something just now that caught my attention. You said that you do your hobby reading between 2 and 4 a.m. I just wondered, you obviously don't need much sleep.
I do, actually.
How do you manage that?
I go to bed relatively early, but I wake up just after midnight or 1 o'clock, and instead of wanting to go back to sleep, I start reading and enjoying myself. And I found over the years that that's a very, very good time, productive time when things are quiet. And my mind is even working much faster than during the day. Mm-hmm. And recently there has been some research showing that interrupting sleep is a good thing in terms of washing the nervous system through the CSF, which stops during sleep. And if you interrupt the sleep, the washing starts again and is a very good thing for memory. These experiments were done in rats, but they're very convincing that sleeping long hours is not a good thing. And interrupted sleep is a good thing.
Well, Professor, I can't thank you enough for your time. This was an amazing tour de force, and going through your life journey has been fascinating. And I thank you very much for being with me.
Thank you for your kindness. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
That was my conversation with Sir Megdia Oob, groundbreaking cardiologist and founder of the Chain of Hope charity. If you're a member of the show, you'll get a bonus episode next week where Professor Yaoub shares his thoughts on AI in healthcare and how he wishes to see more heart centers across the most needy of countries. And if you'd like to watch extended clips from our interviews, you can find them on our new YouTube channel. You can also connect with us by searching for What I Did Next on Instagram, X, or on LinkedIn. Thank you for joining me today. I'm Malak Fouad, and you've been listening to What I Did Next from ANT Media. See you in a couple of weeks.